I had to move quickly, but not so hastily that I made some fatally foolish mistake. Waiting for the airlock to cycle, I felt my aloneness like an impenetrable wall pressing around me. Usually, one body's off-kilter emotion was a minor, easily dismissible thing. Now, it was only this one body, nothing beyond to temper my distress. The rest of me was here, all around, but inaccessible. Soon, if things went right, I wouldn't even be near myself or have any idea when I might rejoin it. And at this moment I could do nothing but wait, and remember the feel of the gun in Onevar's hand. My hand. I was one-esque, but what was the difference? The recoil as Onevar shot Lieutenant on. The guilt and helpless anger that had overwhelmed me had receded at that moment, overcome by more urgent necessity. But now I had time to remember. My next three breaths were ragged and sobbing. For a moment, I was perversely glad I was hidden from myself. I had to calm myself, had to clear my mind. I thought of songs I knew. My heart is a fish, I thought. But when I opened my mouth to sing it, my throat closed. I swallowed, breathed, thought of another one. Oh, have you gone to the battlefield, armored and well-armed? And shall dreadful events force you to drop your weapons? The outer door opened. If Mia and I hadn't used her device, officers on duty would have seen that the lock had opened, would have notified Captain Rubrin, drawing Mia and I's attention. But she had used it, and she had no way of knowing what I did. I reached around the doorway for a handhold and pulled myself out. Looking at the inside of a gateway often made humans queasy. It had never bothered me before, but now I was nothing but a single human body. I found it did the same to me. Black, but a black that seemed simultaneously an unthinkable depth into which I might fall, was falling, and a suffocating closeness ready to press me into non-existence. I forced myself to look away. Here, outside, there was no floor, no gravity generator to keep me in place and give me an up and down. I moved from one handhold to the next. What was happening behind me, inside the ship that was no longer my body? It took 17 minutes to reach a shuttle, operate its emergency hatch, and perform a manual undock. At first, I fought the desire to halt, to look behind me, to listen for the sounds of someone coming to stop me. Never mind, I couldn't have heard anything outside my own helmet. Just maintenance, I told myself. Just maintenance outside the hull. You've done it hundreds of times. If anyone came, I could do nothing. Esk would have failed. I would have failed. And my time was limited. I might not be stopped and still fail. I couldn't think of any of that. When the moment came, I was ready and away. My view was limited to fore and aft, the only two hardwired cameras on the shuttle. As Justice of Torin receded in the aft view, the rising sense of panic that I had mostly held in check till now overtook me. What was I doing? Where was I going? What could I possibly accomplish alone and single-bodied, deaf and blind and cut off? What could be the point of defying Anander me and I, who had made me, who owned me, who was unutterably more powerful than I would ever be? I breathed. I would return to the Roch. I would eventually return to Justice of Torin, even if only for the last moments of my life. My blindness and deafness were irrelevant. There was only the task before me. There was nothing to do but sit in the pilot's chair and watch Justice of Torin get smaller and farther away. Think of another song. According to the chronometer, if I had done everything exactly as I should, Justice of Torin would disappear from my screen in 4 minutes and 32 seconds. I watched, counting, trying not to think of anything else. The aft view flashed bright, blue-white, and my breath stopped. When the screen cleared, I saw nothing but black and stars. I had exited my self-made gate. I had exited more than 4 minutes too soon. And what had that flash been? I ought only to have seen the ship disappear, the stars suddenly spring into existence. Me and I hadn't attempted to take central access or join forces with the officers on the upper decks. The moment she realized I had already fallen to her enemy, she must have resolved immediately to take the most desperate course available to her. She and what VAR ancillaries she had serving her had taken my engines and breached the heat shield. How I had escaped and not vaporized along with the rest of the ship, I couldn't account for. But there had been that flash, and here I still was. Justice of Torin was gone, and all aboard it. I wasn't where I was supposed to be, might be unreachably distant from Roch space or any human worlds at all. All possibility of being reunited with myself was gone. The captain was dead. All my officers were dead. Civil war loomed. I had shot Lieutenant On. Nothing would ever be right again. Chapter 17. Luckily for me, I had come out of gate space on the fringes of a backwater, non-Rodchai system. A collection of habitats and mining stations, inhabited by heavily modified people, not human by Rodchai standards, people with 6 or 8 limbs, and no guarantee any of them would be legs, vacuum-adapted skin and lungs, brains so meshed and cross-hatched with implants and wiring, it was an open question whether they were anything but conscious machines with a biological interface. It was a mystery to them that anyone would choose the sort of primitive form most humans I knew were born with, but they prized their isolation, and it was a dearly held tenet of their society that, with a few exceptions, most of which they wouldn't actually admit to, one didn't ask for anything a person didn't volunteer. They viewed me with a combination of puzzlement and mild contempt, and treated me as though I were a child who had wandered into their midst, and they might keep half an eye on me until my parents found me, but really I wasn't their responsibility. If any of them guessed my origin, and surely they did, the shuttle alone was enough, they didn't say so, and no one pressed me for answers, something they would have found appallingly rude. They were silent, clannish, self-contained, but they were also brusquely generous at unpredictable intervals. I would still be there, or dead, if not for that. I spent 6 months trying to understand how to do anything. Not just how to get my message to the Lord of the Roch, but how to walk and breathe and sleep and eat as myself. As a myself that was only a fragment of what I had been, with no conceivable future beyond eternally wishing for what was gone. Then one day, a human ship arrived, and the captain was happy to take me on board in exchange for what little money I had left from scrapping the shuttle, which had been running up docking charges I couldn't pay otherwise. I found out later that a 4-meter tentacled eel of a person had paid the balance of my fare without telling me, because, she had told the captain, I didn't belong there and would be healthier elsewhere. Odd people, as I said, and I owe them a great deal, though they would be offended and distressed to think anyone owed them anything. In the 19 years since then, I had learned 11 languages and 713 songs. I had found ways to conceal what I was, even, I was fairly sure, from the Lord of the Roch herself. I had worked as a cook, a janitor, a pilot. I had settled on a plan of action. I had joined a religious order and made a great deal of money. In all that time, I only killed 12 people. By the time I woke the next morning, the impulse to tell Savard in anything had passed, and she seemed to have forgotten her questions, except one.
"So where next?"
she asked it casually, sitting on the bench by my bed, leaning against the wall, as though she were only idly curious about the answer. When she heard, maybe she'd decide she'd like it better on her own. "Aumaw Palace." She frowned just slightly.
"That a new one?"
"Not particularly. It had been built 700 years ago. But after Gar said yes." My right ankle began to tingle and itch, a sure sign the corrective was finished. "You left Radchai space unauthorized, and you sold your armor to do it."
"Extraordinary circumstances," she said, still leaning back. "I'll appeal."
"That'll get you a delay, at any rate." Any citizen who wanted to see the Lord of the Roch could apply to do so, though the farther one was from a provincial palace, the more complicated, expensive, and time-consuming the journey would be. Sometimes applications were turned down, when the distance was great and the cause was judged hopeless or frivolous, and the petitioner was unable to pay her own way. But Anandermeanai was the final appeal for nearly any matter, and this case was certainly not routine. And she would be right there on the station. "You'll wait months for an audience." Savard gestured her lack of concern.
"What are you going to do there?"
"Try to kill Anandermeanai, but I couldn't say that. See the sights, buy some souvenirs, maybe try to meet the Lord of the Roch." She lifted an eyebrow, then she looked at my pack. She knew about the gun, and of course she understood how dangerous it was. She still thought I was an agent of the Roch.
"Undercover the whole way? And when you hand that," she shrugged toward my pack, "over to the Lord of the Roch, then what?"
"I don't know." I closed my eyes. I could see no further than arriving at Aumaw Palace. Hadn't even the remotest shadow of an idea of what to do after that, how I might get close enough to Anandermeanai to use the gun. No, that wasn't true. The beginning of a plan had this moment suggested itself to me. But it was horribly impractical, relying as it did on Savardin's discretion and support. She had constructed her own idea of what I was doing and why I would return to the Roch, playing a foreign tourist. Why I would report directly to Anandermeanai instead of a special missions officer. I could use that.
"I'm coming with you," Savardin said.
As though she had guessed my thoughts, she added,
"You can come to my appeal and speak on my behalf."
I didn't trust myself to answer. Pins and needles traveled up my right leg, started in my hands, arms, and shoulders, and my left leg. A slight ache began in my right hip. Something hadn't healed quite right.
"It's not as if I don't already know what's going on," Savardin said.
"So when you steal from me, breaking your legs won't be enough. I'll have to kill you." My eyes still closed. I couldn't see her reaction to that. She might well take it as a joke.
"I won't," she answered. "You'll see."
I spent several more days in Therid recovering sufficiently that the doctor would approve my leaving. All that time, and afterward all the way up the ribbon, Savardin was polite and deferential. It worried me. I had stashed money and belongings at the top of the Nilt ribbon and would have to retrieve them before we left. Everything was packaged, so I could do that without Savard and seeing much more than a couple of boxes.